I see at least two things unique about this site. Mm-hmm. One is its location. Can you describe how this McLean County location is an anomaly, at least for right now, until we know more?
It is very much in the middle of nowhere over here because for the most part around this time, people were living farther along kind of the more major rivers of Illinois, especially if you go farther south down around St. Louis. We have Cahokia, which is kind of the big city of this time. It's kind of the Chicago of 1,000 years ago, you know, so Illinois kind of flip-flopped. The focus is more on southern Illinois. But we have a bunch of people living in northern Illinois as well, more around the Chicagoland area, kind of up to Starved Rock. And then there is kind of this gap in between where we don't really see people living for, I don't know, 50 miles or so, except for at Noble Weeding. We have this kind of off of the main line, the you know, beaten path kind of a thing, where we don't see any other big villages like this. Where we see, you know, the big villages, they tend to be either farther north or to the south.
And along major rivers, it sounds like, not like the Kickapoo. Okay.
Yes.
All right. Well, another seemingly unique thing is that two cultures seem to have kind of come together at this site, what the Langford culture and the, do you call it the broader Mississippian culture?
So the Mississippian, yeah. So that's the big thing here, is that this kind of 50-mile gap in between, you know, the southern and the northern kind of villages that we see kind of corresponds with differences in lifestyles of the people. And so this is a time before written records, so we don't know exactly what the people called themselves. So we tend to name them after important archaeologists or archaeological sites. So we have Langford up north, who made their artifacts and lived in just kind of a different way, versus down south, what we call Mississippians, more around Cahokia, which is, again, as I said, the big city around here, the first city really anywhere in North America, north of the Mayan world in Central America there. And so generally, these folks kind of kept their distance from one another. And we see Mississippian villages and we see Langford villages. And they tend to have different stuff and do different things. And they were, it's hard to say what their relationship was exactly, but they seem to be happy, you know, living their own lives kind of separate from one another.
Okay, well, before I start asking about the differences in their cultures and how they did things, is this a fairly recent discovery that this Noble Weeding site was sort of a convergence of the two cultures?
No, we've known about this for a while. There were excavations in the 60s and 70s. Ed Jelks, who was the first archaeologist here at ISU, he led a number of seasons of excavations at the site and was the first to really kind of figure out and formalize this relationship that, yeah, we have stuff from two different places that's winding up here seemingly at the same time and from the same people.
What were some of those differences that were easy to identify between the Mississippian culture and what's called the Langford culture? And it sounds like the Mississippian culture is a broader culture that the Langford is a part of? Is that how you describe that?
You can, well, so really how we go is the big differences are in how they made their pottery, so their bowls and their cooking vessels and things like that. And so Mississippian, they're all made of clay, but Mississippians mixed in crushed up shell from the rivers into there. You know, think of like bone china. You add extra things to the clay to make it stronger, more heat resistant. Whereas Langford, they mixed in crushed up rocks into their pottery, and they decorated it with some different designs on there as well. So we, as archaeologists, the old saying is pots are not people, in the sense that we don't know if there were bigger divisions, you know, within that of how people made their pottery. But they do reflect these kind of broader traditions and trends that are out there in kind of northern and southern Illinois.
What about the food they grew? Was there a difference between the cultures that way as well?
Well, everybody at this time, Mississippian and Langford and everybody else, their protein sources, so their meat, all came from hunting, essentially. And most people hunted deer. You know, of course, we all know deer are kind of the biggest, most common wild animal out there today, would have been so in the past. But at Noble Weeding, the people that lived there seem to have a big taste for elk. And we find all sorts of elk bones all across the site. And it's, you know, you find some elk kind of mixed in here and there at a lot of sites from this time period. But this seems to be kind of their major food source. And it may be part of the reason why they chose to live kind of out here off the beaten path. This may have been a spot where there were big populations of elk for hunting.
one of the things people talk about is that they were growing corn among other crops, and it's a point that it's, you know, growing hundreds of years before, you know, the Europeans came here and started growing corn. Was that a significant event in its own right that they were growing corn?
Absolutely. Well, by this time, people have been growing corn for a few hundred years. Corn first kind of appears in Central America about 3,000 years or so ago, and makes its way up first into the Southwest, and then eventually comes over here to the Midwest, where people have been growing other things, like sunflowers and lots of plants that we would consider weeds today, like goosefoot and may grass and all these little things that make little seeds, and you know they were doing just fine with those. But corn comes in, and yeah, it really kind of changes everything. We don't really see big villages like this before people start growing corn, and we don't really see a lot of these kind of bigger social differences until corn kind of starts to be grown, and we have kind of this domino effect after that.
What is the significance of the continuing excavation of this site, very unique site?
Mm-hmm. Well, really, our big goal out there, we take students out every year, and it's a class they take. So the big goal is to educate students on just in general how to do, you know, proper scientific archaeology. And we just happen to have this really incredible archaeological resource right down the road from the university. The other part of it is you know, kind of, I guess, for our world today, we can get another example of how different types of people come together and, you know, make it work in kind of this diverse metropolitan type of a setting out here. So one of the things we see a lot of at sites at this time period is a wall or you know, giant fence around the village for protection. So we kind of expected to see that at Noble Weeding. But based on our work last year and based on, we now have a survey that allows us to essentially see under the ground and have kind of a map of where everything is at the site.
Is that what this is right here?
That's
now?
What we have here, thanks to our friends at U of I over there.
Okay. So do you want to, can you point out, and we can post this on our website,
mm-hmm.
can you kind of point out what, you know, all the gray areas and what some of the dark areas on this might
be? Yeah, so we have the gray is just kind of your average natural reading, that's just undisturbed soil out there, whereas anything darker or lighter than that is something potentially of archaeological interest. So you see the thing at the top, that's actually a modern field road. So that's just kind of noise in the archaeological record here. But you can make out little squares and rectangles kind of in this circle all around. Those are all house foundations or structure foundations. And then all the little tiny black dots are probably pits. They would have initially been used to store corn, kind of like an underground silo. And then as the corn is eaten up in those, or as they get, you know, infested with mice or turn sour or whatever happens to them, then they fill them back in with trash, which we love as archaeologists. We love digging through people's
trash.
You can certainly find out a lot about somebody that way.
So how much of the darker spots, which you say are probably structures, how much of this is unearthed now, and how much of this is showing what you still need to unearth?
We have done very, very little, probably, you know, less than 10% of the site has been excavated, certainly much less than that with our work. And then if you add in the stuff from the 60s and 70s, there's still plenty out there to see. The goal is not to dig everything up, just like, you know, if we go back to 1976 when the last excavation was there, if they had dug everything, then there'd be nothing left for us. So we certainly have this preservation side as well, just because techniques advanced, you know, this map never would have been made in the 70s out there, and who knows what new technology will come out in, you know, 40 years or so from now.
Interesting. So only some of this right now is unearthed, is that what you're saying?
Yes. So it's all under it's in an active farm field where they're growing corn and squash, and the landowners are incredibly generous to let us go out there in the middle of their field, you know, that they use for their livelihood, and dig stuff up. The first foot or so of the soil has been churned up by the plow through the years. So you know, we remove that and screen and take the artifacts out of it, and then you get essentially what is this view much closer up. We dug right here, this house.
Pointing right by this road that crosses the top or the northern part of the map, okay.
Yes, it was right by the road, so we decided to dig there just because it was very convenient, and we could step off the road and take a look at what this house was at this point, which is what we have in this one. So what we find are essentially what is the foundation, and so if you think of your house 500 years from now, 600 years from now, you know, the probably all going to be gone, any surface indication of it. But your foundation is probably going to be there, probably because it's made of cement, which they didn't have. But we still have good preservation of wood and other elements in there.
And how many houses have you discovered so far?
So based on the map we have, this overall kind of view, there's about 36 structures in there. Most of them are probably houses. There are some that are a little bigger that were probably either, you know, kind of their religious structures or their kind of town council type structures out there. And then the other big trick is figuring out how many of these were occupied at the same time. Because these are made out of wood, they're just kind of set in the ground. Estimates say they last, any house would last between 5 to 20 years before you then have to rebuild. So it's possible.
Do you have to carbon date them to figure that out?
We have carbon dating from the 70s. The results place the occupation in the early 1200s AD. There was some more recent analysis that was done about 15 years ago that put it into the mid 1350 or so AD. So it's possible that the village, that those are both right, and the village was occupied for 150 or so odd years. It's possible that one or both is wrong out there. But certainly if we have this long occupation, you'd expect that some of these houses would have been, you know, early on and some are later. So it's possible that you only had maybe a dozen houses there at any one time.
So this little village was deserted long before Europeans came through Illinois.
Absolutely. So the big questions we always get as archaeologists are, where did people come from and where did they go when they left here and why did they leave? And ultimately, the answer to all three of those is we don't know. and so we can't point to a particular other village or site where we say, okay, they moved from here to there. But we can say there's no evidence that they were pushed out of here. There's some villages from this time that look like they're burned down, and maybe there was, you know, some sort of warfare going on where people, you know, left in a hurry. There's no evidence of that we find here. Things seem to be relatively peaceful and calm out here. But we do know that at some point they chose to pack up and move on.
Dr. Logan Miller is an assistant professor of anthropology at Illinois State University, and he's leading his students on an archaeological dig at the Noble Weeding site just north of Hayworth here in McLean County. What, other than it being a really close classroom for you, as you mentioned, what's particularly exciting about this site for you?
This is very fun for me. Just, I don't know, everything. Just, you know, basic things about, you know, the thrill of discovery. You find something that you know was made 600-800 years ago and nobody has touched since then. But it's also really kind of filling in a big piece of the puzzle here. You know, sometimes as you're trying to learn about overall patterns, it really helps to look at the anomaly, the one that doesn't really fit. If you're trying to understand, you know, these broader ideas about Langford or Mississippian or whatever that may be.
So does that throw everything that you know about these people out of whack when you find an anomaly like this?
Sometimes it does. Luckily, I guess in some sense, we don't know a whole lot about what we call the Langford tradition. There's only been a few of these villages that have been excavated, and much less so than what we know about what's happening at Cahokia. That's where most of the focus has been, in kind of southern Illinois. And so we're still kind of patching together this view of the frontiers or the periphery that we have around it.
So when you're on a dig like this, are you looking for something to help fill in a gap that you know is there, or are you just digging and whatever happens, happens?
It's a little bit of both. In archaeology, you at some level don't really know what you're going to come into. We have this wonderful map, which is a huge advantage, even, you know, what we would have had, you know, 10 years or so ago. But the old adage is you still have to dig. You still have to get in there and get your hands dirty and figure out what's going on. So, yeah, we do have research questions that guide us, and we have plenty of things that we would love to see and love to find. But at the same time, what's preserved there is there. And you kind of have to go with what the ground gives you, really.
Any surprises when you're out there with your students?
Probably the most exciting finds that we had in the field, just in terms of the stuff this year, we found a few bits of copper that would have come from around probably Lake Superior region and been traded down here. Maybe it was traded through Cahokia and made its way here, but we found a copper part of a rolled copper bead that would have been part of a necklace or somebody's clothing. So it's always cool to find those kind of personal items because, of course, the people are long gone. We get just kind of an aggregate view. We get their trash, you know, things they got rid of they didn't want anymore. So it's fun to find these beads that probably would have been a really important, probably highly valued thing that was just accidentally lost in there.
How long you been at ISU?
It's almost the end of my third year.
Third year.
Here.
So did you know this was there when you came to ISU? Or?
I did not, no. And
you must have been pretty excited when you found it.
I was very excited. My own kind of archaeological journey started with, you know, a similar kind of experience to this. When I did my undergraduate work at Wright State in Ohio, there was a really big, important archaeological site just down the road from the university. And so I got this opportunity to go out that, you know, I didn't have the time or the money to fly to the other side of the world to participate in excavation for a month or two. And I can really kind of chalk up all my success in archaeology to that initial opportunity that I had. So I really wanted to provide that. Not every student has the time to kind of drop everything and go far away for the whole summer. So I think it's really important to have these local opportunities, not only for the students, but also, you know, I'm here with the local population in general, so that we can do things like this and really kind of connect with the people who are part of the land at this point.